Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 85 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's going on?
Well, it's hotter than you know what here, but that's the story.
It's your turn to say that.
Across the country, I think we hit 100 yesterday, maybe 101 today, but it's not quite as humid, so I guess it could be worse.
Yeah, it's actually, I think it's cooler down here than it is where you are. And then even up north, somebody was telling me up in the Maryland area, it's like murder hot, and it's not quite so bad as it is down here. I was out for a bike ride today, and it wasn't quite so bad.
So other than that, it's fantastic.
Outstanding. Larry, I am super over the top stoked about our guest tonight. Our guest is Andrew Torres. Andrew's an attorney at the law offices of P. Andrew Torres. Also the co-host of an excellent podcast called Opening Arguments. He's a Harvard graduate with honors, and after working at some big law firms in the D.C. area, started his own firm in 2015 serving small businesses. Andrew, thank you so very much for joining us tonight. I really, really appreciate it, and I do love your podcast. That's a genuine compliment, and really happy you're here.
Well, Andy, Larry, thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the kind words. Thanks for supporting our show for as long as I can remember. So
it's about 10 months, I think.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. So I know those kind words are heartfelt, and that means a lot to me. So,
and in the for the last handful of days, I have been struggling keeping up with podcasts because I have so many. And I was like, oh my God, I have 6 opening arguments in the queue. And I've been binge listening over the last 3 or 4 days just to make sure I was up to par on anything that you may have said recently. So I did get through everything but yesterday's release.
Well, that's quite an accomplishment. They tend to go on from we shoot for 60 minutes and they always somehow tend to wind up in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
And I've been told I speak rather quickly, so it's not like you can do the 1.5x
I do. Trick I do 1.3 or 2.
I used to coach. I still do now. Actually, my son is involved again in a high school debate where the kids speak pretty quickly. So I am comfortable with talking fast, and I think I'm I so are you if you can listen to me on 1.3. so
and actually I was doing some sound check stuff yesterday, and obviously we're way off topic, but I was doing some sound check stuff and I listened to your web stream at normal speed, and it was like, oh my God, this is so slow.
speed it up it come
was
on yeah
brutal it was brutal. We have a mountain of content to get into. And do you have any particular place that you would like to begin?
Was that to me?
I'll
put myself in your hands. So right, gentlemen, whatever you think is best.
I will say this one other thing that your podcast is so much larger than ours that I'm honored that you're here, but your podcast is probably 20 or 30 times our size. So, we're trying to fill some big shoes here to step up to your level.
if I can give a slight side note on that, a lot of people know I am legal counsel for Puzzle and a Thunderstorm, which produces the Scathing Atheist, God Awful Movies, and a couple of other shows. And I got that gig by being a fan of those shows. And I met up with the hosts at a convention in 2016. This was before I started Opening Arguments, before I was podcasting, before I ever
thought I would
be doing this for a living. Yeah. And when I met Noah, who's one of the co-hosts on Scathing, he told me that his view of doing shows was, he said, look, yeah, like, and their show is the largest in that respective community, right? Like it's a huge show. And he said, yeah, he said, I'll do anybody's show, right? 3 guys in their basement, I'll do that show, with 0 listeners, because I have always viewed this about creating community. And that's how I look at alternative shows, as I look at them as the community and not the competition. And that's stuck with me for 3+ years. I really respect that perspective and try to embody it as much as I can. So, you got people out here that God bless you. You love Law Geekery as much as I do. I want to support that as much as possible. So,
and we're certainly here talking about a crazy controversial subject as it is. And, so we've built a little bit of a core fan base, and, bringing you on is certainly outside of our, not somebody inside of our sphere of influence, so to speak. And, trying to tailor the conversation, into area of just legalese and how this ties into the registry in general. Well, one of the first questions that I wanted to get into is, on your show, you're covering so much news, and I'm very curious about your process and how do you verify, how do you make sure that you're not like quote unquote fake news, and how do you keep it not slanted so far one way or the other and all that? And I'm really interested because personally, I feel that your information is solid, accurate, and on par. And then you throw in the legal aspect and you're citing US code and all that stuff. And so I was just curious about your process behind that.
Yeah. So thanks for the question. I'm going to give you two answers to that, right? The first is, I will not cover a story in a main segment. And we do, the kind of classic radio ABC segments on the show. The middle segment is typically the longer one. We bookend it with, the fun stuff like Thomas Takes the Bar Exam and show stuff. I may talk about a breaking story in a pre-show segment, but I will not devote a main segment to a story, no matter how big it is in the news, unless the underlying documents are available. And I always describe what those documents are, right? And the reason, right, is the reason for the genesis of the show, which is that newspapers, TV shows, online media outlets, no matter how great those journalists are, they're not lawyers, and they get stuff wrong. And that was kind of the original thought process for, why we do opening arguments is to take those stories that are being reported and explain, how they're being misreported. And let me give you a really, really good example that has really stuck with me. When Donald Trump promulgated the first executive order, what is called the Muslim ban, which he then mm-hmm. turned into the travel ban. But I mean, it was just called the Muslim ban the first time, the first executive order, back in February of 2017. The ACLU, on behalf of various plaintiffs, went into federal court and got an injunction blocking that executive order from going into effect. And the night that happened, the ACLU put up on their page, and again, right, this is the American Civil Liberties Union. They employ hundreds of lawyers. They have tens of thousands of lawyers that support them. And the story they went with was federal court rules that Muslim ban is unconstitutional. And that wasn't remotely true. That wasn't true at all. And it wasn't true at the time. What they did was the federal court had issued a preliminary injunction saying, we think there are reasons to prevent this executive order from going into effect. And principally the reason for the first injunction blocking that executive order was that initial version, which is since been called EO1 in subsequent litigation. But that EO1 did not provide a provision for American citizens abroad to return home. That seems crazy, mm-hmm. but that's right. The administration we were dealing with, and they were rushing to get this thing out, and everybody involved was incompetent. And so that first EO was crucially defective on an obvious point of law. And the ACLU should have known better, right? I'm not going to say who's responsible for putting up that headline. But I will say that headline was totally misleading. And we went out and we did a show that night and we said, look, you can get on, and we're with them. Like, we wish that, but that's not what the court says. And by the way, when the court ultimately rules on the merits of this, the court is going to decide that a version of this executive order is in fact constitutional. That's what happened, right? So that's a bit of a long-winded way of saying that if I don't have the primary documents, I'm not comfortable going forward with covering the story in any kind of depth. And then related to that, I want to tell you when I do the segments on the show, I confine those comments to this is what the documents say, and this is what you can reasonably infer from those documents, right? This is slightly orthogonal to that, but another thing, before I started doing opening arguments, I was a regular consumer of op-eds. I liberal cred out here, whatever. I would watch Rachel Maddow every evening, and there were opinion columnists that I really, really enjoyed reading. I don't do that anymore. And I don't do that because I don't want subconsciously to be part of a leftist echo chamber, right? Like I know where my politics are. I know where I'm going to come out. If we wind up saying similar things, then, you know, that happens because of how we've analyzed the situation. But I don't want even subconsciously to wind up parroting. So that's a sacrifice I make for the show, because I really like Rachel Maddow. I think she's really good. I think she does great kind of long form reporting. But I gave that up. So,
well then, so, but how do you then, I pick my media, and I know that Larry picks his media, and you know, that's sort of where you fit in enough. Obviously that is your filter bubble. So then how do you make sure that you're not, staying so far leaning in one direction and you're hearing at least, you know, some sort of the other side's arguments, so to speak?
So I try, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the question, right? Like in my view, it doesn't matter kind of where the initial reporting comes from. And look, most of that reporting comes from, Google alerts and social media, right? Like I've got a pretty complex web of stuff that, that I have set up. I check SCOTUS blog every morning, when the court's in session, that sort of thing. But once I've been alerted to the story, where I'm going to go from there is to the documents. So I to me, that's what kind of checks against the idea of bias, right? Because, you know, you are entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. So
that's true. That's true. And I'm asking that question because I know that Larry regularly listens to right-wing radio just so that he knows their talking points. And I don't want to speak on your behalf, Larry. Please elaborate on that. Like, what is your thought process, Larry, behind how you go through that process?
Well, I do it for just what you stated. When I hear folks expressing their views, or not much their views, but when they start making comments about something, you know, the whether it be about the unemployment rate or whether it be about I know that oftentimes the source is right-wing radio, and I listen to the right-wing radio as much as I can stand it, usually when I'm in my car, but sometimes when I'm just around the house. But I listen to it so I'll know what their arguments are and how they're getting people hyped up, because they tend to create a lot of imaginary problems that don't exist. You know, they're good on solutions in search of a problem. And so I like to know what problem they're creating next that doesn't exist. So it's my way of being one step ahead, or at least I understand where this, all this emotion is coming from. When you create the illusion of a problem, some problems that they talk about are just way vastly overblown beyond all comprehension, but they make it sound as if, you know, that there's thousands and thousands of babies being killed after they've come through the birth canal. That's just simply not true. but they create this illusion of an imaginary problem, and they do it on a lot of issues. So that's the way I find out information about what's up, is by listening to them.
So, you know, this reminds me of a story. I don't know if you know the saga of Justin Amash, the Republican, former Republican congressman from Michigan. He was the only Republican to come out in favor of impeachment after having actually read the Mueller report. He was elected in 2010 to the House Freedom Caucus, right? So he was a part of that Tea Party wave. He is as far right. I mean, he's got a 100% voting record from the Club for Growth, right? Like it's his conservative bona fides are unimpeachable. And he just resigned from the Republican Party a week ago. And basically what he said was, I think the problem is that the Republican members of Congress haven't read the Mueller report, because if you read this, it details crimes that the president has committed and essentially says, I mean, all but says, if the subject of this investigation were Donald Smith instead of Donald Trump, we would indict him for these 10 crimes. And I'm stunned that people behave otherwise. And he said this at a town hall. And so one of his constituents, this was actually captured and picked up by, I think, John Oliver, said, well, I get my news from Fox News, and they told me that the Mueller report was a total in exoneration of the president. and so, you know, I mean, it's just to me, that is the crisis of our time going forward, is that when you have a media outlet that is a propaganda arm of the administration that has no bones about saying things that the people saying it on air know to be false, that's a new crisis that I don't know that our government is well set up to combat. So that's a real problem to me.
Larry.
I echo that. I have not. I'll confess, I have not read the Mueller report. The reason why I haven't read it is too lengthy, and I know that nothing's going to become of it because the numbers are not there. If we don't have the situation we had in 1973, 74, when we actually had people who were trying to be objective, want to know, Republicans saying, "What did the president know, and when did he know it?" That spirit of protecting. It's no longer present in the current bunch that we have in leadership. So it's like, I can read till I'm blue in the face, but nothing's going to happen because regardless of what the House representative does, nothing's going to get through the Senate.
Right. Right.
I strongly disagree with that. Right. Like, perhaps I'm too much of an optimist. I mean, let me say, I was shocked when the Mueller report came out. I said, that I expected that Bill Barr would be impeached within a month, because what Bill Barr did was provably it wasn't perjury because it wasn't under oath, but the letter that he wrote ostensibly summarizing the Mueller report is as fraudulent as you can possibly get, right? And we broke this down on my show. I mean, he cut quotes from the Mueller report that began with "notwithstanding," comma, right? And they would just cut the after effect, right? Like it was as dishonest as I have seen from any public official in my lifetime. So I've been disappointed by the lack of reaction, but I think that the reason for that is Larry, what you said, that the Mueller report's long, and unlike the Starr report, right, it doesn't talk about blowjobs, so people, you know, get bored and stop reading after a couple of pages. I think that this is why I've come around, and I believe, you know, Mueller's testimony before the House of Representatives, it's going to be televised this coming Wednesday, eventual upcoming impeachment proceedings. I think just having in prime time to folks who have not read how damning and how I'll just stick with that, who have not read the Mueller report, I think just repeating that in soundbite form in an unfiltered way where you can't say, oh, that's fake news, it doesn't, right? And when you have Mueller himself saying what he will say on Wednesday, yes, if this were any other person, I would have recommended that they be indicted, but you can't indict a sitting president in my view, so that's why I didn't. I think that has a large potential to move, you know, the people who can be persuaded. Yeah. Trump has a base that can't be persuaded. That's not 46%, right? That is not the sum total of people who voted for him. There are low information voters who voted for him, who continue to be swayed by things like Fox News. And I think if you can go around that, if you can disintermediate the opinion sources, I think those people can be persuaded. Again, maybe a hopeless optimist, but you know, I love this country. I'm a U.S. lawyer, and I have to believe that the rule of law means something.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right.
Well, I almost think that would tie us into the next question of, are we pushing the boundaries of the three co-equal branches of government in the way that we have the federal judges being appointed at a rapid pace by one and a half branches and the, you know, anyway, please, please. Are we pushing those boundaries?
Yes.
so we are. So, okay.
Yeah. Right. So first, let's validate the factual predicate of your question. And that is, numerically speaking, because Mitch McConnell blocked pretty much every Obama judicial appointment in the last 2 years of his term, that meant Donald Trump got to take over and immediately fill 2 years of Obama judicial appointments, plus now 2.5 years of his own appointments. And so as a result, mathematically, in less than one term, if you compare the number of federal district court judges and federal the circuit courts of appeal judges appointed by both Obama and George W. Bush in 8 years, right? Because both were two-term presidents, but both appointed roughly 55 circuit court judges, and Trump is on his way. He's over 40 at this point, right? So he's at roughly 80% of Obama and Bush appointees in 2.5 years. So as compared to two full terms for those presidents, that is really, really unprecedented numerically. And then when you look at Trump's judicial appointees, every single one of them who has come up for a vote because they have been personally approved by Leonard Leo, the chair of the Federalist Society. And it is difficult. Again, I know, right? I've just gone on. I want to see Trump impeached. I'm a lefty, blah, 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 blah. It is difficult to explain how far to the right the Federalist Society is. I can tell you this, right? Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed 96-3 when she was appointed. The idea that this is the right wing counterbalance to Ruth Bader Ginsburg is as far a shifting of the Overton window as you could possibly imagine. These people represent an extreme fringe view. The Federalist Society was founded right around the time, a couple of years before when I went to law school. I'm old. And I was in law school from 1994 to 1997. And it is the right wing equivalent of the Students for a Democratic Society, right? The communist organization. It is the equivalent of your Ayn Rand group or, the campus anarchists or whatever. The idea that the Federalist Society is dictating a presidential administration's policy on judges would be laughable if it were not happening to us. And you need to understand this about the Federalist Society. They have a hardcore, extreme, near anarchist position about the role of government. Okay. And they know, right. But, and by the way, like, I mean, these are, you know, especially when you're talking about somebody like Brett Kavanaugh, right. Neil Gorsuch, right. You're talking about two unimpeachably intelligent people. They realize that this position, I suppose I should describe what that position is. That position is the current iteration of Ronald Reagan's let's reduce government to the size where we can fit it in a bathtub and then drown it in the bathtub, right? It is a view that literally everything the government does is wrong, and that the government which governs best is the government which governs least. We could have a philosophical debate about that position. I think it's patently ridiculous. And I think anybody who's ever worked in a corporate office will understand that private sector bureaucracy is just as bad as governmental bureaucracy. But we don't have to go down that rabbit trail right now. It is distinctly not the view of the overwhelming majority of this country. And so if you are committed to the idea that everything government does is terrible, right. That leads to things, right? Like, so literally one of the first executive orders that Trump promulgated in January of 2017 was the nonsensical, like, well, we're going to repeal two regulations for every one that we pass. Right. That's mind-boggling, right? Like that requires a level of distrust of government that borders on the fanatical. And to inculcate that belief, at the same time, what Donald Trump is doing, and what the Federalist Society wants to accomplish is to deliberately make it harder for the government to do its job, so that you can point to it and go, see, we told you they were terrible. Right. So, you know, Trump has 11 major executive agencies for which the heads are vacant. They are woefully understaffed. And there's been sort of no effort to do the boots on the ground job that even, for example, you know, was done under George W. Bush. I would recommend, parenthetically, I recommend this to everyone, but Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, is a harrowing tale of sort of criminal mismanagement by the government, by the Trump administration. But here's how this all ties into what the Federalist Society wants to do. The Federalist Society has set its eyes on, again, this is not crazy lefty Andrew Torres advancing a conspiracy theory. Google Federalist Society administrative state. Okay. For the past decade, the preeminent, let me not exaggerate. One of the goals of the Federalist Society has been to dismantle what they call the administrative state. The administrative state are the executive branch departments that are the way in which government gets run, right? So all of your executive branch officials, including the Department of Justice, the Department of Commerce, the Department of the Treasury, the Department of Education, right? All of these executive branches are what they call the administrative state. And what they want to do is they want to make it harder for executive branches to do their job. And people always ask me, well, why would they want to do that when you have a Republican president who's appointed conservatives to head all of these executive agencies? And the answer is that the Federalist Society has a long-term view. They know the presidency changes hands. Republicans get elected, Democrats get elected, things come and go. Obama will pass executive orders, Trump will repeal them, Elizabeth Warren will repeal those in 2020, right? It those things oscillate, but the institutional structure of government persists. And so what they are trying to do is attack those foundations of the basic structure of how our government gets things done. And you know, as a show listener, you know, one of my hobby horses here that is starting to percolate up into mainstream media is the topic of Chevron deference. Probably too much for us to get into today, but I think it is well established. I don't think I'm out on a limb here saying these people want to destroy the government's ability to function in order to buttress their argument that the government can't function.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
So I would just go back to the very beginning of the point that he made about the obstruction of the judicial appointments. Now, it always gets thrown up by the conservatives that we did the same thing on the liberal side. And as Andrew pointed out, it's unprecedented. I tell people, if you just want to look back and present forward, I mean, when he was a non-elected president, wasn't elected vice president, and John Paul Stevens was his choice, and he was, I think, confirmed unanimously in pretty much record time. And then you go back. Yes, they did block Bork. They did block Doug Ginsburg back in the 80s, and then they did block Miguel Estrada. But advising consent doesn't mean that you can't block anybody. It just means that what the Republicans did is they had a blanket block, not only on the judicial appointments, but on executive, on things that the president, you would think, would not be controversial. They blocked everything for Obama. Yeah. They were obstructionist on everything the president tried to do. And it's amazing that the economy recovered for 96 months straight, or whatever it was, for all the obstruction they put in to place to try for the man to fail and for them to be rooting for a fail. In fact, the most listened to talk show host in America said, "I hope he fails." So, I mean, yep. It's not the same thing. It's absolutely it's not even comparable. Should the Democrats have blocked Bork? Maybe so, maybe not. Should they have blocked Ginsburg? Maybe so, maybe not. But they did not block the entire confirmation process of a Republican president. So for people out there to say that they do the same thing, no, they have not done the same thing.
Yeah, I want to tackle two things that you just said, Larry, and I want to say parenthetically, like, one of the things I try and do on my show, I try and do here, I try and do everywhere, is call out when both sides do it right. So, for example, one of the crushing problems facing our democracy right now is gerrymandering. And this is a situation, Andy, you and I live in the state of Maryland, which is 65% Democratic and is gerrymandered to produce 7 Democratic congressional districts and 1 Republican, right? The fair distribution should probably be 5-3 or 6-2, and it's 7-1, right? So this is something that it's fair to say both sides do. Republicans have been more ruthless about it because they controlled more state legislatures and governorships in 2010 when the computer technology was sufficient to enable them to do it. Had the Democrats been in power, they probably would have done the same thing, right? So I try and be attuned when this is a both sides do it problem. Larry, as you point out, what the Republicans have done is literally unprecedented. It is not a both sides do it. And I want to tackle two things. So number one, I'll give you a real life example. This is a personal friend of mine, someone I went to law school with. Her name is Stephanie Gallagher. We were in the same study group together for a time. And she is a well-respected U.S. magistrate judge and is a Republican, was nominated by Obama to ascend to the vacant spot on the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland, and was summarily blocked by Mitch McConnell. She's been renominated to the federal bench by Donald Trump because the Federalist Society doesn't have any, 32-year-old hack candidates here in Maryland, I guess. It is a clear case, right, where she was blocked because she was an Obama appointee and then was renominated because, it sort of percolated back up. Like this is not, a crazy lefty. This is a conservative, impeccably qualified judge that, was sort of thrown a bone in the Obama administration. So there was absolutely a, if you come with Obama attached, you are going to get blocked in a way that the Democrats never did. I want to talk about Bork and Ginsburg, and let me take the second one last. Doug Ginsburg was mostly torpedoed by Republicans. Doug Ginsburg was a law professor, and the evidence came to light in 1986. It was a different time that he had smoked pot with his law students.
Yes.
And that offended mostly the conservatives in the Senate. He was not voted down, but Reagan withdrew his nomination.
He withdrew, yes.
So that was not an ideological block. That was a block based on what was sort of perceived as how can you be a professor of the law if you're breaking the law, I think was the rhetoric that was used at the time. That obviously today that seems sort of quaint, but that was not ideological. I would put in the same camp. George W. Bush tried to make a nepotism pick when he picked Harriet Myers, who had been White House counsel and who appears to truly not be a very bright human being, to be on the Supreme Court. And it was mostly far right wing groups, including Focus on the Family, who said, we don't think this person is academically, intellectually up for the challenge. And ultimately, Bush withdrew Harriet Myers. So I don't view those as comparable. Bork was torpedoed by the Democratic Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired at the time by Joe Biden. This in my view was what elevated Joe Biden to be a top rung contender for the Democratic nomination in 1988, and then was voted down somewhat unexpectedly and with I believe 7 Republican votes against Bork in the full Senate. And the reason is really, really simple. Robert Bork, despite having the same ideological judicial temperament as Sam Alito and Antonin Scalia and Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, the Democrats, Joe Biden, successfully took the argument to the American people that constitutional originalism, as espoused by Robert Bork, was a disqualifying philosophy in the same way that if Robert Bork had been a a communist, right, or a fascist, or, you know, had believed in some other principle of jurisprudence that is contrary to the workings of the Constitution, that disqualifies you, right? You can be, and Bork is super smart, right? I think he's still alive. He's an incredibly smart guy, but he's an incredibly smart guy with a judicial philosophy that, in my view, is disqualifying for being on the Supreme Court, in the same way that Randall Kennedy of the Critical Legal Studies movement, far left, would be disqualifying for being on the Supreme Court, not because he's not smart, but because you have to be faithful to the Constitution. If we have 5 minutes, I would love to get into why I think it's disqualifying. But I feel very strongly about that.
Bork is actually deceased, but he also was torpedoed by the because of the Saturday Massacre. He was the one who actually went through the Attorney General Ellett Richardson and Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus. Nobody would fire the special prosecutor, and Bork said, "Well, by golly, President Nixon wants him fired. I'll do my duty and I'll fire the SOB." So he was the one who actually let special prosecutor Archibald Cox go in the Saturday Night Massacre, and that was also playing into the consideration of his confirmation, as I recall it anyway.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. And he was, I believe, third in line. He was, I think, Solicitor
was, yes.
General at the time.
Yes, he was Solicitor General.
Yep. So the AG said no. The deputy AG said no. And Robert Bork said, "How high, Mr. Nixon?" So I certainly agree with that. I think that those characterizations play a role. But I really appreciate that in the Bork confirmation process, the Senate Judiciary really took the question to the American people of what does it mean to sit on the Supreme Court? Because I know what that means to me, right? To me, that means you are tasked with interpreting the core constitutional principles that have successfully governed this nation for 230 years. And it is a very, very solemn duty. And it needs to be understood in light of the particular and unique role that the Supreme Court has, right? Which is to say, the Supreme Court is the only counter-majoritarian or at least non-majoritarian institution in our government. Deliberately so, right? If you look at the founding fathers, they wanted to create one of the branches of government that was not instantly or even indirectly responsible to the will of the public. And the reason that you want to do that, this comes from the famous and celebrated footnote 4 from the Supreme Court's Caroline Products decision, is the recognition that there are certain people. The phrase that the Supreme Court used in Caroline Products, again, a century ago, was discrete and insular minorities, which is a way of saying some people, if you just leave it to the vagaries of the political process, are incredibly easy to marginalize and to keep marginalized. Some majorities may come and go, right? Like you're not likely to see in, let's say the state of Virginia, right, which is 50-50, you're not likely to see a law that says, Democrats have to pay more taxes or Republicans, can't vote or what, because, right, we might be 51-49 Democrat right now, but we'll be, 51-49 Republican in a couple of years. Those majorities are fluid. But you know what? The state of Utah is never going to be 60% African American, right? That's what the Supreme Court means by discrete and insular minorities. Folks who can't get a coalition together to win their rights at the ballot box. And the Supreme Court is tasked with protecting those folks, with checking the impulses of the majority when they go to infringe upon the rights of the minority. And Robert Bork's jurisprudence was openly dismissive of that role. And for that reason, I continue to think that I fight back because the right is hijacked and they used, Borked as a verb, meaning, to be mean to Supreme Court appointees or whatever. That's what advice and consent is meant to be. It's meant to protect us from having justices like Robert Bork.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
So something that comes up within like criminal justice reform issues, and you know, we could drive right up against like the Second Amendment and then even like the Eighth Amendment, where you would have originalism versus, and you said it, and I don't remember, we talked on the podcast about a week ago, you used the term originalism, and then you said my philosophy is something that relied on precedent, and I was really hoping that you could drill into that, on how some people go by some 1800s view of the world versus something that has not quite evolved but has been honored by precedent in the past.
So I would, there's not a good word for the kind of jurisprudence that isn't originalism, because it is, and again, I'm trying not to overstate the position here. This is the view that almost every lawyer in the country, left, right, center, has, right? It is what I would call the ordinary model of jurisprudence. I often describe myself as a small C conservative when it comes to jurisprudence. And it goes something like this. It says, let's start with the kind of signpost, bumper sticker slogans of originalism, right? Which says, laws and constitutional provisions mean what the founders, what the people who wrote them said they mean, and not what some later court comes around and tries to impose on the text, right? And that has, I think, a lot of surface level plausibility. Right. It makes sense. You sit there and you're like, yeah, right. The law means what the lawmaker said it does, and not what, you know, some court coming along. Well, like that hits at our kind of emotional sense of fairness. But the game, the reason why this is super effective is because what originalists are doing is eliding over the level of abstraction as to what laws mean. And here's what I mean by that. Our constitution, and let's not talk about laws, because, you know, statutes sort of vary, and it's kind of hard to pin down. Let's talk about the Constitution, right? And it is clear to a reasonably bright elementary school kid that what the Constitution does is enshrine certain principles into law, right? So the Fifth Amendment says that you cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, right? There is no plain meaning. What's a process? How much of it are you due? What's your liberty, right? It's designed to protect a principle, and then we look to the courts to figure out the contours of what that principle means, of how it gets applied in practice. Where originalism goes off the rails is by saying it does not matter what our history, right, which is that is the idea of precedent. It does not matter what past courts have said liberty under the Fifth Amendment means. The only thing that matters is what the framers intended it to mean, which, by the way, means whatever I, as Justice Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, think the founders intended this to mean. And they want it to be applied incredibly specific. And I can prove to you beyond a shadow of a doubt that this philosophy is so radical that it was considered unthinkable as recently as 20 years ago. And here's how I can prove that, again, with no, factor in whatever anyone's opinion the other way. The 14th Amendment says no person may be deprived of life, liberty, of equal protection of the laws, right? And that is incorporated to the states. That was passed after the end of the Civil War, and it was designed to say that the constitutional guarantees also apply as well in Maryland and Massachusetts as they do in Alabama and South Carolina. It is also clear, abundantly clear, that the framers of the 14th Amendment at the time that it was passed and for 100 years thereafter did not think specifically that that meant that African-American students had to go to the same schools as white kids. Okay, we know this for a fact because the people who voted for the 14th Amendment voted to have segregated schools in the District of Columbia, right? This is not a hard question. Nobody thought equal protection, you know, they thought in 1868, right, they thought equal protection meant, you know, vote and that kind of thing. But like, you know, we don't need to keep them in the same schools as my white kids. And that was the Supreme Court's holding in Plessy versus Ferguson, 1898, right? Said separate but equal, totally fine, right? And that is an originalist interpretation of the 14th Amendment. The most celebrated Supreme Court decision in our nation's history is Brown versus Board of Education from 1954, which overturned Plessy v. Ferguson and said, you know what? Separate is inherently unequal. We said this in Plessy v. Ferguson, and we just got it wrong. And if we are to truly live up to the ideals of equal protection under the law, then we can't have a system that keeps black kids and white kids in separate schools. And there's a reason why that is, again, the most, I'm not exaggerating, celebrated Supreme Court decision in our nation's history. Robert Bork refused to say that, as said in print, that Brown v. Board of Education was wrongly decided. In his confirmation hearings, he walked it back as a matter of practicality. I used to have the quote committed to memory. It was something like, I have seen that the effects of the cruelty of that. Yeah, but as a matter of jurisprudence, if you are an originalist, the answer to the question, did the framers of the 14th Amendment intend for equal protection to apply to black and white kids in the same school? The answer to that is super obvious for the reasons that I've just explained. If you're not an originalist, if you subscribe to the ordinary model of jurisprudence, then you look at it and go, oh, this is an easy question too. The 14th Amendment enshrined a principle into the law. It said we should be equal. What does equal mean? Well, you got to figure out equal on a case-by-case basis. Does that change? Do we think equal now means something different than equal meant 50 years ago, than something meant 200 years ago? Yeah, we do. And that's what the founders intended. That was always the way the system was supposed to work. And so that's why I strongly, you know, continue to argue against originalism. I point out that the bumper sticker philosophy that it uses to gain acceptance is actually turned on its head. That it is a judicial philosophy that puts maximal power in the hands of the judge. I can prove that too. but that's kind of my. I was going to say 5 minutes. I think I ranted a little bit longer than that. I apologize, but
please rant as long as you want. To be honest with you, and Larry, I'm sure you have points to bring out in there too.
Well, it's I would be repeating what he said. You know, we've talked about Plessy versus Ferguson. We've talked about the nonsensical view that the conservatives say this evolving standards of decency or it's just all hogwash. And that's what he was just pointing out there, that of course, what's equal today, how we define equal to be different. What the founding fathers thought of equal was in those times. So according to the conservative doctrine, as we've evolved as a society and decided we were wrong about what constituted equality 200 plus years ago, then we could never change that. That's the most ridiculous thing that you could ever imagine. But that would be their view. So I rather than spending a lot of time, I would just say I don't find anything I disagree with that Andrew said.
I appreciate that. And I just want to emphasize that having my view, having the ordinary view of jurisprudence constrains what a judge can do. right? What it means is that once a court, once the Supreme Court has previously ruled on a case, that's called precedent. And you have to take that into account when you rule on the next case, right? And so give you a perfect example, right? The Supreme Court in a 1971 case called Abood was asked to consider whether the provision requiring individuals who are part of a union to pay dues to that union for representing, this is a public sector union, this is the public school teachers in the Abood case, whether that union could apportion the administrative costs of representing individuals to its members, even if the members disagreed with the other political stuff the union did, right? Not apportioning the lobbying costs, but apportioning their administrative costs. And so the Supreme Court had to balance out the liberty and associational interests of individuals against the First Amendment to the Constitution. And what they ruled was, you know what, we're going to draw the line at the union putting its political dues out to involuntarily out to its members, right? We think there's a problem when the union says, regardless of whether you agree with us or not, if the union donates X dollars to candidate Y, we're going to pass that on to you in the form of your dues. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that violates the First Amendment. You know, you get to decide whether your money directly goes to candidate Y or not. But the fact that the union needs dues to organize in order to then collectively bargain with your employer, in this case with the government, to get working conditions and salaries and bonuses and everything else, it's fair for them to pass those costs on to you. And so what that means is, if you have a normal Supreme Court, if you have judges who care about precedent, that question is settled. You don't get to, that we know what the law is. It now becomes predictable. That's the primary benchmark of the rule of law. We know exactly what that means. And what it meant was what happened, which was after 1971, states could pass so-called right-to-work laws. They could restrict unions and say we're not, but that would be up to the public to decide. You had no inherent constitutional right to demand that your state be a right-to-work state. And the question was solved. And the only time in which we go back and reopen settled questions is when we have a Plessy v. Ferguson kind of situation where it's clear that, like, thus, the law, while being definitively answered, was definitively answered in such an egregiously wrong way as to merit the entire court going, we got this wrong. We're really, really sorry. And now we're changing our mind. But we do so not lightly. We do so with a heavy hand and heart. And we do so in the most extreme of circumstances. This Supreme Court does not care about that rule anymore. They do not care about following precedent. And the case that I just described, Abood, the right-wing activists picked a guy named Mark Janus, and they relitigated it for no better reason than the fact that they have a more conservative Supreme Court now, and they thought they'd have a chance at winning, and they won term. Janus versus Ask Me, exact same fact pattern, exact same rule. This court says, you know what? We're going to change that because I like the way Janus came out. That should be terrifying if you want to constrain the power of judges. It is not if you are the Federalist Society and you realize that you have engineered a right-wing takeover of the judiciary, and so you want judges to have as much power as possible. I realize that sounds a little conspiracy-esque, but you know, the opinions speak for themselves, right? Clarence Thomas just wrote in a concurrence in a case called Gamble versus United States that, understanding this legal system, the key premise that words in written laws are capable of objective, ascertainable meaning when faced with a demonstrably erroneous precedent, my rule is simple, we should not follow it. That should be terrifying to people to read, right? That is Clarence Thomas saying, I don't care how many times this Supreme Court has answered this question in the negative. If I think it's the other way, that precedent is demonstrably erroneous and I'm not going to follow it. That grotesquely undermines the way in which this court has operated, the Supreme Court has operated for more than two centuries. That terrifies me.
I too am terrified, Andrew.
All right. Well, since we just finished up that little piece, and I think that would be a great time to move on to your analysis of the Gundy decision that, I don't know, what was that, 2 months ago, Larry?
Oh, not that long. About a month. Okay.
Andrew, what is your take on Gundy?
Okay. So, so Gundy is a really, really interesting decision in terms of law geekery, which means it's really, really interesting to me. And it's one of these that I think is very, very hard to understand what happened until you kind of get way into the weeds, right? Because this is a case where what the case is about isn't really what the decision is about. So,
right.
So the facts. In 2006, Congress passed the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, and it requires those convicted after the passage of the act to provide state governments with certain registry information, right? Names, current addresses, and it includes different tiers. So some offenses you register for 15 years, some for 25, some for life. And at the same time that that act, that SORNA, was passed, Congress also said, we want to do something about existing individuals who have been convicted of sexual offenses. But they didn't, and this is really the crucial point, they didn't just say that the law applied both prospectively and retrospectively. They could have done that. We could have a separate debate, but Gundy is not about the law being ex post facto. It is not about it applying retroactively. It was stipulated for purposes of the argument that the law would be constitutional had Congress applied it retrospectively. So kind of put that public policy aspect to the side. Congress didn't do that. They didn't say it's going to apply both prospectively and retrospectively. Instead, what they said was that it was going to be up to the Attorney General to determine how to apply the provisions retrospectively to people who were convicted sex offenders at the time that it was passed, right? Specific language, the Attorney General shall have the authority to specify the applicability of the requirements of this subchapter to sex offender offenders convicted before the enactment of this chapter and to prescribe rules for the registration of any such sex offender, okay? And this is the concept of delegation. And I want to explain how crucial it is that this kind of delegation from Congress to executive agencies, right here to the Department of Justice, an executive branch agency headed by the Attorney General. Almost all of our laws have some version of this kind of delegation. And the reason that they do that is because Congress can pass sort of broad sweeping laws, but it's really easy to evade broad sweeping laws. I'll give you a perfect example of that. In 1994, Congress passed an assault weapons ban, right? And that assault weapons ban listed, I believe, 39 different weapons that were then prohibited as a matter of federal law once that law passed, right? And it prohibited, you know, the AK-47. And instantly, right, this does not take a lot of imagination. If the law says you can't make an AK-47 and sell it, it's super easy to make the AK-47A and put a new little nozzle on it and print it up. And again, I'm not talking about the merits of, you know, whether you're pro or anti-gun control. If you specify stuff in a law, you can then evade that law by just changing it a little bit, right? So then imagine, and subsequent states have done this. This hasn't passed at the federal level because we don't pass laws anymore. But states will say, we are going to prohibit the AR-15 and any substantially similar semi-automatic firearm as may be promulgated by the state, you know, Bureau of Firearms from time to time, right? And that is delegation, right? It says, look, Congress passed the law, but in order to ensure that the law works on the ground, because we're a nation of 350 million people and it's super duper complicated and we don't want people evading the law, we delegate rulemaking authority to an executive branch agency that's charged with enforcement. And again, this happens all the time. But as I said in the previous segment, the goal of the Federalist Society, the goal of the people running Donald Trump's judicial appointments, is to prevent government from working. And so the argument that was advanced by the petitioners in the Gundy case was something called the non-delegation doctrine. Said, we want you to rule that Congress can't delegate out stuff like this to an executive branch agency, and we want you to overturn this law on the basis of the fact that it represents an impermissible delegation of legislative authority from the Congress to an executive branch. And while the Gundy decision was 5-3 upholding the lower court's decision, the lower courts were like, get out of here with this, right? The law is super clear. The non-delegation doctrine is incredibly narrow and basically says that so long as there is let me get the exact language of the non-delegation doctrine, which is that the court, it's called the intelligible principle test, and it says it is constitutionally sufficient if Congress clearly delineates the general policy, the public agency which is to apply it, and the boundaries of this delegated authority, which again, SORNA clearly applies, right? We know what the policy is. We know which agency is to apply it. We know how far they get to apply it. And so, again, should be a slam dunk question unless you have a court packed full of Republican right-wing activists. So you might be asking yourself, if I've just told you the court is packed with Republican right-wing activists, how come Gundy didn't come out the other way? How come they didn't jettison the revive a super duper version of the non-delegation doctrine, strike down this law and cripple the administrative state? And the answer is because Brett Kavanaugh wasn't on the court yet. And if you're sitting there thinking, well, but Andrew, you told me it was five, because it was only eight judges on the court at the time. And you're saying, but Andrew, you told me it was 5-3. I did. And you might be like, well, I can add 1-3 is still only 4. That still seems to come out the other way. That's not the way this opinion came down. This opinion was 4-3 with Justice Alito concurring only in the judgment, and concurring only for this reason. And I want to read what Alito said, because I think, like, again, a lot of what I'm saying sounds like it might be hyperbolic. If anything, I'm being not alarmist enough. Here's what Alito said. Since 1935, the court has uniformly rejected non-delegation arguments and has upheld provisions that authorized agencies to adopt important rules pursuant to extraordinarily capricious standards. Okay. That sounds like a good reason to continue to do so. Then he says, if a majority of this court were willing to reconsider the approach we have taken for the past 84 years, I would support that effort. But because a majority is not willing to do that, it would be freakish to single out this one here for special treatment. There's no clearer way, right? The three justices in the minority were Gorsuch, Thomas, and Roberts. You can add Kavanaugh to that list. He's written a law review article about the non-delegation doctrine. He clearly wants to reverse it. The next crack at this that the extreme right is going to take will produce a 5-4 decision the other way. And Alito said, I'm ready to join you guys. Just give me a majority. The reason he didn't join the dissent in this case has to do with a weird procedural quirk. Like if it would have made the decision 4-4, which would have let the Second Circuit opinion stand and would have further narrowed the holding. And so it actually would have made it stronger for the case. Sorry, puppy again.
Oh, they're the law dogs.
Yep. It actually would have made it harder to revive the non-delegation doctrine had he voted with the minority. So weird procedural quirk. The writing is on the wall. I mean, I read it to you. You don't get more clear than Alito going, give me one more person who wants to overturn this thing. It's only been in effect for 84 years. I mean, you know, why should we care about overturning 84 years of how this court does stuff? I think that also kind of nicely ties into the previous segment where, you know, I told you that this court is blatantly cavalier about disregarding nearly a century of precedent.
So I was when I read the decision, one thing that was apparent to me is the court really didn't understand sex offender registration, and very few people do. There is no federal registry. And you know, the way that decision was written is like that the attorney general would have difficulty registering some of these people. The attorney general doesn't register anybody. There is no federal registration process. There's merely a look into the state registries through a federal website. But the funny thing about this is if it had gone the other way, exactly what we have today would still be in place. We would still have 50 sex offender registries that would operate exactly the way they do today. No one would rush to repeal the registration requirements, and they wouldn't cease to prosecute people. He could have been prosecuted under state law. It's just that the feds found him first for him traveling. It was already the law that when he moved from one state to the other that he needed to register, and which is what the Adam Walsh Act was hoping to cure, was the tens of thousands, reportedly 100,000, who had just simply moved across state boundaries and didn't register because the states they left was happy that they were gone, and the state they had moved to didn't know they were there. And the state that they had moved from had no incentive to spend their resources to bring the sex offender back. So they looked for a way to federalize a prosecution, which they modeled after the interstate flight to avoid prosecution. They needed a jurisdictional hook, so they said, well, why not the Commerce Clause? Well, that's how they – but the man could have been prosecuted under state law, and of course they intended this to be retroactive. What kind of sense would it have made from a policy perspective that you'd want – if you have 100,000 sex offenders missing, that you'd say, well, we ain't going to worry too much about them. We'll let them continue to roam the countryside unaccounted for. Reckon we won't worry about them. Well, that would mean that it would only be applicable to those starting as of August, whatever it was, 2006. Well, we'll start looking for those that travel today that don't tell anybody about it, but we'll let the 100,000. Oh, well, if they were convicted prior to before this was enacted, we won't even worry about them. So what you would have had would have been a license for everybody to travel. So the 100,000 that was missing, they would not be subject to prosecution. And the people who are already registering under state law, they would have no ability to prosecute those. So you would only have a small segment of sex offenders starting with number one that got convicted after. And that would be so ridiculous from a policy perspective that, of course, that's not what they meant. The only reason they delegated that was that because each state has a different constitution. Each state has different precedent, had already at that time had different precedents in terms of interpreting how the registration could be applied. And only the Attorney General of the Department of Justice would understand the nuances of working with the states to try to figure out how they could apply what was intended to be applied retroactively. But it didn't create your duty to register. That was already in place.
No, I appreciate. I think I draw sort of two lessons away from that. I really, really appreciate the color and the explanation on the facts there. Number one, I think that you have really, you know, very powerfully summarized the general principle that I was talking about, which is that, you know, this is the way in which laws get done, right? That administrative delegation In the absence of administrative delegation, it is almost impossible to imagine how to make laws work, which again is the goal of these people, right? Like that they want to make it impossible to pass laws, and to pass laws that are effective. And I think that your description there really powerfully illustrates that. And then second, I think it also illustrates where I started with, which is they picked that this happened to be the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. This could have been any act, right? It this was not about the underlying facts. The significance of the case is about the procedure that leads to it, right? In the same way that for example, Marbury versus Madison, right, was about, right, mattered very intently to Bill Marbury, who did not get his writ of mandamus demanding that he be allowed to be appointed to a judgeship, and so it hurt him personally, but of course that decision established the Supreme Court's power of judicial review, which has sort of gone on to have rather more wide ranging effects than whether Bill Marbury got to be a judge or not. And that's I would say that this is not Marbury versus Madison decision, but it's illustrative of a situation where the facts and the underlying dispute aren't necessarily correlated to the significance of the opinion.
Well, I will get a lot of hate mail, so I want to clarify that this is not an endorsement of the registry. It's just simply the reality of the situation.
Yep. No, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Congress was faced with a national policy that they had encouraged the states to adopt 10 years before with the passing of Jacob Wetterling. And they had discovered after 10 years of experimentation that the policy was not a very good one, because in their mind, if 100,000 could go off grid by simply moving across state boundaries, they had to figure out a way to deal with that. And to let them remain missing and allow everybody who's already registered to continue to not be subject to the federal prosecution. That's what this really was about, was the federal prosecution. That particular section of which I can't cite the number, but the federal prosecution is what this man was complaining about. He got federally prosecuted.
And my point that I think would synthesize that is you can be opposed, right? Yeah. That you can be pro SORNA or opposed to SORNA, but the idea that you would parse it out and say it would, that, again, the position that Gorsuch articulates in his dissent that will become the law of the land by the end of the next Supreme Court term, is SORNA is constitutional if it had specified precisely how the registry was to apply to those who were already convicted, but becomes unconstitutional because it delegates that prior decision back to the attorneys general because of the interlocking federal and state system that you talked about. That, again, to me, the only possible justification you can have for coming to that conclusion is one that is rooted in the idea of I don't want government to be able to work properly.
In their minds that any delegation, we don't need that. And of course, if you tried to make a law that was so broad that would cover every scenario, you just can't.
No, it's again, it is part of a concerted effort to convince people that the government doesn't work by sabotaging the government's ability to work.
Well, I tried to use on the podcast where we talked about it, I tried to use the example of Social Security disability. Congress defines that a disabling condition as a physical or mental disorder, severe, that prohibits a person from engaging in substantial gainful activity for 12 months or more, or result in the person's death. They leave the nuances of how to do that up to the administrative state, because they could never, ever move quickly enough to specify all the disability, the first line disabilities, and then all the combinations thereof of impairments that could be constitute a disabling condition. And then as we evolve, new disabilities, health things that we haven't heard of crop up, and things that we used to think were disabling, we learned that, AIDS is not nearly as disabling as we thought it was in the 1980s. That was a ticket to disability. Well, if Congress had to make these adjustments, these programs could not function. And I wonder if people went down to their VA and they said, well, we would give you disability, but there's only 14 items on the list here. They haven't updated it since 1997. So what you've got is not on the list. I wonder if they'd be happy with that.
That is exactly right. That I could not have said it better myself.
So of course we have to have an administrative state. We have to have experts who make decisions within the framework. Congress wants people to receive Social Security disability benefits if they have the requisite quarters in to be covered. If they for your age, which it varies according to how many, it's half the time since you're 21. If you're less than 40, I think, and then you have to have at least 10 quarters of credit. They specify that. They specify that it has to be disabling enough to substantial gainful activity. They specify substantial gainful activity, but they don't do the list of impairments. They don't do the combination of the list of impairments. They don't do all that. The administrative state does that. An administrative law judge reviews that if you disagree with your decision. That's the only way Social Security disability could ever work and pay disability benefits to several millions of Americans. But
amen.
Then the next thing that we were going to discuss was about the there's a recent case where a judge in New Jersey has been driven from office. He gave a decision. He used his judicial authority to interpret, and the public has pushed him out. And I'm not sure, Andrew, if you're familiar with the Judge Persky thing that happened about a year ago. And this is another one where the public just, you know, the mob
that
rule.
That was the Stanford swimmer, the judge who was recalled in California.
Yep.
And so this seems to be happening again. And I wanted you to give your opinion on the public forcing judges out to bad public pressure.
And here's an area where, you know, maybe I'll get the hate mail from, you know, from my lefty fans. In both of these cases, you have a substantive outcome and the reasons, therefore, which, again, to me, are appalling, right? It is, we know all of the best evidence shows how underreported rape is and how, the degree to which this is just in many cases, an almost insurmountable obstacle for women to be a part of the process. There's a really, really good, I don't have the Law Review article on the tip of my fingertips, but I can probably look it up. That documents statistically exactly how hard it is to get women to come forward. And the New Jersey judge was like this kid comes from a good family and whatever. And again, you know, you can understand why these decisions shock the conscience and prompt public outrage. But I think you will find it not surprising in light of the jurisprudence that I've articulated, and particularly in light of the judicial independence thesis that I've articulated, that having public pressure drive judges from office strikes me as a terrible, terrible thing for precisely the kind of communities that that most need to have independent judges. I mentioned the Caroline Products decision. If the unique and special role of the judiciary is to stand up for marginalized, discrete, and insular minorities, the very last thing you want is for judges to be looking over their shoulder going, oh, well, if I rule in this unpopular way, I could be forced from the bench. Even when, you know, that means that we have to deal with decisions that reify privilege and that reify, you know, sort of truly atrocious decision making. I think the solution to that is is more education, is having a more diverse federal and certainly these are state court judges, but you know, having a more diverse judiciary. It is dangerous and troubling to me to see that to see judges forced from office because of the public reaction because of precisely that kind of judicial independence that I think is important.
Something that you just spoke to, though, that it almost sounds, yes, these are horrible cases, but should you throw all of the weight of something being underreported, should you then slam all of that on someone that does end up in the auspices of the judicial system?
I'm not sure I understand the grammar of the question.
Well, the idea that someone commits what, I mean, you know, the New Jersey kid, you know, filming it and then, I don't know if you followed all this, but he then started distributing the video around and everyone gets a hold of the copy of him having sex with, like a drunken party. And I don't want to minimize that, you know, there's an act and then she's being humiliated repeatedly and all this stuff. So then the judge, probably knowing how impactful the registry is on someone's life and finding housing, finding a job, he's a young kid, they're trying to elevate it to adult court, he's going to go to adult prison, and he's going to have a massive problem in his life going forward. And I don't mean to say anything that minimizes what the girl has gone through on top of that. So he says he comes from a good family, he has a chance to be rehabilitated. The public then takes all of the undocumented rape kits, all the untested is the word I'm looking for. And it then seems that the public is then taking all of that and putting it on top of this one defendant. That's where I'm trying to go with that. And I hope I cleared that up.
Yeah, no, it does somewhat. And I'm not sure that I agree with that. Right. In the sense that, And now, you know, we're in the realm of speculation because, I haven't followed the story on the level that, you know, that you have. I know the story. If the justification, right, like, because the response back to that is, look, it's all well and good that this judge is now giving a rehabilitation-based justification for the criminal justice system. And probably the folks, you know, calling for his head, people like me, are pro moving the justice system in the direction of rehabilitation and away from, you know, Kantian retributivism lex talionis. But the proper question would then be, but how consistently are you applying that principle? What do we infer when you throw the book at African American defendants who are convicted of minor drug possession crimes, but all of a sudden you care about rehabilitation when it's a young white kid from a rich prep school and an upstanding quote family? Those are real institutional bias questions, and something can be a principle with which I agree that nevertheless is monstrous in practice. Give you a really, really good example of that. The argument deployed by the religious right in the early 2000s in academic circles, right? This is even a little earlier, as I debated this as part of a roundtable when I was in law school. 1996 was, well, you know, government shouldn't be in the marriage business at all, right? That should just be private contract. So, you know, of course we wouldn't want government to get into the gay marriage business, right? And it takes a tenth of a second, right? Again, a reasonably bright middle schooler can look at that and be like, Well, it's kind of interesting that you've discovered this newfound, hyper-libertarian view of government should get out of marriage when it applies to gay marriage. And, you know, you weren't in the business of raising that argument when it applied to heterosexual marriage. And of course that's correct, right? Like, so in other words, something can be the proper principle, but selective application of that principle could nevertheless be troubling. So that's sort of my first initial response to that is, if you're thinking there is sort of piling on the defendant, I would argue the other way, which is it seems to me that there are very few, you know, even your most liberal judges, trial court judges in this country, there are very few who are out there consistently applying the principle of rehabilitation in every case. And we should be rightfully suspicious when all of a sudden, we can rehabilitate the white kid. That troubles me. And
And, no, I would agree with that too. And Larry, I'm sorry, I interrupted you before.
I'm going to have to push on this one just a tad bit, because I agree. I agree that there's a systemic bias, but it's more of an economic bias, in my opinion, in the years I've been involved in practice of law. If you read that decision, I will call that, for the sake of discussion, that was an amenability hearing, which is what we have here for juveniles, but that's not exactly what they call it in New Jersey. But it was a decision being made whether or not he would be transferred to the waiver, as they call it, to adult court. Well, a person who has financial resources, if you read the appellate decision where they admonished the judge, the evidentiary hearing lasted several days. A person who comes from the ghetto was not going to have the legal resources to put together a 3 or 4 day hearing on their amenability to treatment and to rehabilitation. So that's a systemic bias that's based on economics. The person who comes from the ghetto is probably not going to have the supportive parents who are going to be able to provide the guidance and counseling. They may not even have any parents at all. And that's an economic systemic bias that we have. The reality of the situation is a person who comes from a broken home in the ghetto is not going to have the support structure in place that's going to make them a good candidate for rehabilitation. Now, I'm for that, but that would mean we would have to dig into our pockets as a society, and we would have to provide resources that would be very expensive, because when you take a person that doesn't have what the judge described in that is one of the factors, that person is starting out at a lot more disadvantage, because even if you want to rehabilitate that person and you want to divert them, you don't have the resources available. That requires an investment that society has been unwilling to give. We don't have those type of programs. We don't have that type of social services. We don't want to spend that kind of money. And so he did get a 3 day hearing about his amenability for rehabilitation, and he had good representation. That's a systemic bias. I don't know if it's the judge's bias because he wouldn't want to rehabilitate a black kid. I don't think he got the opportunity to make a decision on the black kid, because they don't get the opportunity to have those 3 day hearings very often.
So a couple of points with respect to that. And I'm not sure that we disagree too much here. Number one, right. The idea behind implicit bias is that you're not aware of it, right? And the social science literature on that is overwhelming. I mean, we don't have the time to delve into it, but I think it is as close to an established fact in social science as you can possibly get.
Agreed.
We certainly agree on the underlying economic conditions, and I would point out those economic conditions are strongly correlated to race, about as strong as you can possibly get, such that it, in my view, it is not difficult to draw causal inference. And I would just say, you know, the way to think about that is start ordering from the bottom up, the worst public school systems in this country, and you will begin and travel, you know, hundreds of school districts before you get outside districts that are not just predominantly, but virtually 100% African American. And that persists to this day. And that persists for a ton of structural factors, including, the fact that that schools have been relegated as a local matter, that they've been funded by property tax, that redlining and institutional discrimination in housing markets has meant that African Americans in this country live in the poorest areas, attend the poorest schools, have the structural problems that make it difficult to break out of structural poverty. So I certainly agree with you, right? Like, I mean, you know, and as practitioners, you see this all the time, that the difference between somebody who has access to resources and their ability to then to utilize the justice system is on a completely different level with someone who doesn't. So I agree with that. I think it doesn't. I think and just with respect to racial bias, I would say number one, strong correlation, and number two, it doesn't cover the landscape, right? I mean, you know, my one of my mentors, the late Andre Davis, talked about as a sitting judge would routinely get stopped for driving while black, you know, as an affluent sitting federal judge in his 70s. It was heartbreaking, right? And, you know, and the lesson there that I took away is, you know, if it's happening to an Andre Davis, it's happening to everybody. It sounds like we don't really disagree on that.
Yeah, it's just that I believe that a person, when you take an overwhelmed public defender who's trying to get that case off of his docket as quickly as possible, there's not going to be that 3-day hearing to start with. There's going to be at most a very brief hearing on amenability and rehabilitative. And then you compound that with the person from the ghetto probably would not have the resources. And the state is not having to provide all the resources. I mean, you do need some structure when we do, and I do very little in the way of juvenile law, but when there's an amenability hearing here, the standard is that there has to be no program to get a kid in adult court here is very difficult because you have to show that they're not amenable to any treatment anywhere in the state of New Mexico, and the state bears the burden of proving that. And Cody Posey, which listeners hear me talk about all the time, killed his father, his mother, and his sister. He was 14 years old. That was Sam Donaldson's ranch here in New Mexico, and he was not able to be waived to adult court, despite the severity. The test is not how severe the crime is, how heinous crimes can be. That crime, looking at that the New Jersey judge was looking at, looks pretty appalling. You know, to have sex with someone who's intoxicated and to film it and to transmit that, that's kind of gross. But it's a 16-year-old. Do we want to write off the 16-year-old for the rest of their life because of that mistake? I think not.
Now we've disagreements, and I would just ask, why? What are the factors that all of a sudden? And you may be consistent on this, right? Like, so you've talked about prior cases. Maybe you have. I have no reason to doubt that you have been consistent on the show and in public life in being pro rehabilitation. Something I try and do as well. I would ask, with respect to this particular judge, Judge Troiano, why do you think this particular defendant tripped his, all of a sudden we care about rehabilitation, when the hundreds of African-American defendants who came through his courtroom who have committed minor property crimes, drug possession crimes, considerably lesser offenses in considerably more understandable circumstances with lack of economic means. Why didn't those trigger his sense of empathy?
Well, that's information I don't have in terms of, yeah, how many waivers he's denied, how many he's granted. And the New Jersey standards are different than my standards, but I would hope that I've been as consistent as possible. I would want the states around the country to be more in line with our standards, that you don't put a kid in adult court unless they're not amenable to rehabilitation. And that's a very serious part of the process to determine if they're amenable. And it's a high burden the state has to overcome. And prosecutors gripe about that. This judge, I don't know enough about. So if he has a history of never granting, I mean, of always granting the waiver and not granting this one, that would be information I'm not in possession of. So I don't know that.
And I want to be clear, right? I am a civil law practitioner, right? So when we're talking about boots on the ground, this isn't the kind of decision that I face as a lawyer every day. But I think that it is, I mean, we sort of move beyond. If the top line question was, is it a good idea to have public outcry affect essentially force judges from office, I think we're all in agreement that that's not a great idea. The discussion sort of morphed into, but is the public right to be outraged here? And I'm strongly on the side of the public is right to be outraged here. And hopefully, you know, that if the way to morph the discussion and to have something good come about it is to say, let's take the empathy that you have for the rich white kid who goes to the good school. And again, I mean, that's the judge's language, right? Like his exact words were, he comes from a good family who put him into an excellent school where he was doing extremely well. He's a candidate, not just for college, but probably a good college. That's great, right? Like I want judges to be looking at, at the ability to rehabilitate kids. But I want them to do so in a way that is consistent and that, that, does not, systematically reward people who are like them and punish those who are other. And the good school, good job, good college, that, that troubles me a lot. Because I don't, again, I don't know this judge at all. I don't practice in this kind of area. But that's very often code for racist, classist language. That is, oh yeah, well, this kid, right. He's getting terrible grades in a bad school in East St. Louis. I mean, you know, well, there, as you so eloquently pointed out, right? Like there, there are, a number of overwhelming structural factors, that make it really, really hard for a kid, you know, in a single family home that is, you know, economically devastated in the worst school district in the country, to compile the same kind of record that, that the kid did in this case. So I don't think we're saying too much of a difference here, but I do want to be clear on that.
Well, Andy, go ahead, Larry.
I was about to say the same thing. I think we probably have reached the limit of what our audience.
Oh, we have. absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're at like an hour and 40 minutes, so we definitely need to shut it down. Andrew, please tell people how to listen to your podcast and anything else that you want to plug.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. My show is Opening Arguments, so you can Google that. It's at OpenArgs, OpenArgs on Twitter. You start typing Opening Arguments into Google, you'll find the show. And if you like this kind of stuff of deep dives into the law that, you know, hopefully informed and contextualized, then, you know, give us a look.
I think it's an awesome podcast. I enjoy it very much. It's one of my top listens for sure. And you were plugging an awards thing. I can't remember. Had that been,
That's still going on for about a week or so. We are up for the podcast awards in news and politics and best overall podcast category. So I've got my fingers crossed on that.
Cool.
You know, we're up against some stiff competition. This is a big, this is the 14th annual podcast awards. So, you know, the shows that win are, you know, huge.
The Skeptic's Guide has won for like 7 years straight or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not quite as big as Skeptic's Guide, but hopefully we get some, notice, recognition. We get out there and, we get to a bit of a wider audience because, I certainly love what we're doing. So,
you guys do a great job. Thank you so much for coming on, Andrew.
I'm really gratified by your kind words there. And Andy and Larry, I had a great time on this. Have a good evening. Thank you so much for having me on.
Very good.
Thanks for being with us. And how do other people join us and help us grow? What do people need to do to make this podcast an even bigger success?
So there are a couple places. First of all, go to registrymatters.co. And again, don't ask me why I picked CO. It's just something that happened. And your favorite, and we haven't had any voicemails for a while, but please, if you have voicemails, hit 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And lastly, support the podcast. And Larry, what is it, gross or net?
Yes, it's your net paycheck.
Net paycheck at patreon.com/registrymatters. And with that, Larry, thank you so much. Thank you again, Andrew. And you guys have a great night. I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the FYP Network.